moving into our next session, which has a particular focus on the Canadian context. Our keynote speaker for this session is Anne Leahy. Anne Leahy was her previous post, long distinguished diplomatic career in Canada. Her most recent post, which I think concluded in January of 2013, with a extension with the appointment election of a new pope. Her most recent appointment was to the Holy See for the last 4 years, from 2008. Ambassador Leahy is an economist, a specialist on Russia, has represented Canadian interests abroad in several countries, including Ambassador to Cameroon, Chad, Central African Republic, Ambassador to Russia, Armenia, Poland. Her other posts were at the Mission of Canada to the European Community in Brussels at the time of the negotiation of the Framework of Agreement, and to the Organization for Cooperation and Economic Development in Paris as Counselor and Representative to the Development Assistance Committee. She has also served as Ambassador to the Great Lakes region of Africa from 2004 to 2007 and chaired the Group of Friends of the Great Lakes in that area, that constitute 28 countries and international organizations, so some extensive experience within the African context. As a diplomat in residence at York University, she has taught courses on international development, the aftermath of the collapse of communism in Europe. She's the Director General of the Policy Planning Bureau in Foreign Affairs, and she's published in a number of journals, and also currently heads up international, or is one of the directors of the International Relations Bureau in UCAM as well.
The Institute.
Ambassador Leahy has been very active with the McGill's Faculty of Religious Studies and has been a key player in the development of this course and conference. And so we're honored to have your presence and turn over the floor to you.
Thank you very much, Dan. I was tempted, following our first speaker, to say, not only am I not a lawyer, a theologian, a scholar, I'm not an activist. I'm just a Canadian Foreign Service officer who's been around for 40 years. But nevertheless, the subject of religion and foreign policy, Canadian perspective, is a very broad one. Even if foreign policy somewhat circumscribes the issue, the reality is that foreign policy is not the sole preserve of a national government, nor of the executive branch of government, and that it always involves a significant number of stakeholders who play a role in its formulation and delivery. So I haven't surveyed the extent of academic studies in the area, and I'm also very conscious that the issue of religion, religious freedom, and foreign policy tends to be very much an issue of Western countries. It's a preoccupation we seem to have here in North America and Western Europe, but I'm very conscious there's a certain bias in that just from the start. But nevertheless, I'll offer some thoughts from the perspective of a Canadian diplomat with 40 years of experience and well aware of my limitations and of the presence of Andrew Bennett in this room. So let me say a few words about religion as a subject of foreign policy. I find it's an unusual and sensitive one. It's unusual in the sense that while it was never really extraneous to foreign policy making, it was not really singled out explicitly until the 1990s in academia or foreign ministries as a dimension of foreign policy. It's certainly sensitive because the definition and role of religion are open to interpretation. We referred earlier to the wonderful discussions with Elizabeth Hurd earlier, and that certainly came out. So we might say that it relates to the spiritual world and it has a sacred dimension intrinsic to every human being. Religion is intensely personal, yet it is a global phenomenon. It is intimately linked to identity of a person, a community, and may even define national identity. A notable feature, a recent feature about religion in North America, is the growth in number of people who profess no religious affiliation and also who define themselves as spiritual but not religious. It happens that the public role and expression of religious belief are challenged in the very countries that make religion an explicit feature of their foreign policy. So I would propose to bring out these elements, these following elements, in the treatment of religion in Canada's foreign policy. Consistency. Canada's foreign policy and practice of diplomacy have considered religious freedom as part of the defense and promotion of human rights for as long as I can remember. This is consistent with and solidly grounded in the foundational values of our country. Coherence. If our understanding of the secular state evolves to the point of marginalizing the contribution that religion brings to society, we will be less persuasive in engaging other countries on freedom of religious expression. Focus on the person. Religious freedom relates to individuals and persons belonging to communities, not to religion per se. The body of international human rights law relates to persons and communities. Let me quote a well-known speech, or should be well-known anyway, in Canada. I quote, "No foreign policy is consistent nor coherent over a period of years unless it is based upon some conception of human values. I know that we live in an age where it is fashionable to speak in terms only of hard realism in the conduct of international affairs. I realize also that at best, the practice of any policy is a poor approximation of ideals upon which it may be based. I am sure, however, that in our national life, we are continually influenced by the conceptions of good and evil, which emerged from Hebrew and Greek civilizations, which have been transformed and transmitted through the Christian traditions of the Western world. These are values that lay emphasis on the importance of the individual, on the place of moral principles, in the conduct of human relations, on standards of judgment that transcend mere material well-being. They have ever influenced our national life as we have built a modern state from east to west across this continent. I'm equally convinced that on the basis of this common experience, we shall discern the same values in world affairs and that we shall seek to protect and nurture them." Someone wants to hazard a guess? This was said by the Right Honorable Louis Saint-Laurent, who was then Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs Minister, who spoke these words in 1947 at the University of Toronto. In February of this year, the Canadian government appointed the first Canadian ambassador for religious freedom. Prime Minister Harper announced the creation of an Office of Religious Freedom in the speech from the throne in October 2011. He situated it clearly in the context of promotion of human rights and linked it directly to the promotion of pluralism. The proposal for an Office for Religious Freedom had first appeared in the Conservative Party's electoral program published in April 2011. I'll read its description in the program because it provides the elements of the mandate of the office. So the purpose is defending religious freedom. Around the world, vulnerable religious minorities are subject to persecution, violence, and repression. Canada has a proud tradition of defending fundamental human rights, such as freedom of religion and freedom of conscience, And our government recognizes that respect for religious pluralism is inextricably linked to democratic development. But we can and should do more to respond to the plight of those who suffer merely because of their faith. We will create an Office of Religious Freedom in the Department of Foreign Affairs to monitor religious freedom around the world, to promote religious freedom as a key objective of Canadian foreign policy, and to advance policies and programs that support religious freedom. Second, it will continue to ensure that Canada offers its protection to vulnerable religious minorities through our generous refugee resettlement programs. And thirdly, ensure that the Canadian International Development Agency works with groups supporting such vulnerable minorities. That was in 2011. Back in 2004, the Subcommittee on Human Rights and International Development of the Standing Committee on Foreign Affairs and International Trade, Parliamentary Committee, held a session on persecution of people of faith. I know that some people in this room participated in this hearing. The following agreed motion gives an idea of the strength of the advocacy and the preparedness of the parliamentarians to support their efforts. The motion read that the ongoing, at that time, International Policy Review, examine ways in which the Government of Canada can make the protection and promotion of the right to freedom of religion and belief a central element of its efforts to defend human rights internationally, including in its development policy and programs. And here's an interesting point, and in particular, to look at ways of making the receipt of Canadian aid conditional upon the absence of systematic abuse of religious and other fundamental human rights. We didn't go this route. The promotion of human rights is clearly anchored in our national identity. It is in our national interests of social cohesion at home and international stability. It stems from our history as a multicultural and multi-confessional country that has welcomed people of different traditions from around the world. Since 1911, 100 years ago, the percentage of the foreign-born population in Canada has varied between 15 and 22% consistently over 100 years. From the latest household survey done in 2011, and the results were published in May, this last month, we learned that one Canadian in five was born outside the country. In the largest metropolitan area, Toronto, 46% of the population was born outside Canada. It's definitely national interest that we get along together and that we respect each other. There are therefore several communities in Canada that are naturally concerned about their family and relations abroad who suffer because of their faith. It's an important constituency that, along with religious and spiritual leaders, turn actively to the government to intervene on their behalf and support their efforts. With the creation of the Office of Religious Freedom, the government committed to do more to respond to their plight, essentially through the Refugee Resettlement Program and CEDA. The past 60 years of Canadian foreign policy document the efforts of successive governments to help and advance, to help people and advance international legal protection of freedom of conscience and religion. We can be grateful to John Humphrey, law professor at McGill, who as secretary to the committee had a direct hand in the drafting of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948. In fact, an initial draft of the declaration was found in his personal papers a few years later. Our generous humanitarian and refugee policies have helped people fleeing their country for various reasons, including religious persecution throughout the decades. A major element of the office's mandate is to, quote, monitor religious freedom from around the world. Now, this also has long been a feature of the Department of Foreign Affairs global human rights policy and bilateral relations. I can go back in my personal experience when I was posted to the Canadian Embassy to the Soviet Union in Moscow in 1980. And religious affairs was part of my job description as first secretary there. And I wasn't the only one in a Canadian embassy, depending on which countries you were in, to have religious affairs in specified as part of the human rights responsibility that generally, you know, middle, right, first secretaries would have as a responsibility. So this included not only advising Canadian officials and comparing notes with concerned groups at home, but also making representations on behalf of individuals. I remember personally Jewish dissidents, Pentecostalists, and Ukrainian Greco-Catholics. The Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade has also for many years held regular roundtable consultations on religious freedom with civil society organizations and religious representatives in preparation for large United Nations meetings, in particular the UN Council for Human Rights in Geneva. When we were holding them, we had religious freedom as part of the discussions in our official bilateral human rights dialogues with China, Cuba, and Indonesia. What I find most interesting and at the same time the most challenging in the mandate of the new office is the call to, quote, promote religious freedom as a key objective of foreign policy and advance policies and programs that support religious freedom. This is an interesting evolution in the place religious freedom, and I'll even argue later, religion occupies visibly for the public in our foreign policy. The Prime Minister singled out religious freedom as an objective in itself and a key one of Canadian foreign policy. He implicitly put its promotion on a level equal to that of other major interests, such as economic prosperity and security. If this is indeed the intention, it will presumably require some mechanisms in the government administration that reflect this increased emphasis and with which to work out what are not always complementary interests. This would be building on a solid foundation. In the 1990s, the Minister of Foreign Affairs had already stated that, quote, freedom of religion is a basic human right, and that, quote, protecting and advancing freedom of religion is an intrinsic part of Canada's human security agenda. The link between the protection and promotion of human rights and security was clearly made. In the early 1990s, human security became the focus of our diplomatic efforts with several like-minded countries, notably Norway. And we worked together on a series of initiatives suitable to the new geostrategic era that followed the disappearance of a superpower bloc politics. Going back to that era, the three decades-long meetings on security and cooperation in Europe, the CSCE, then OSCE, established that violations of human rights, including freedom of religion, were not just an internal affair, but of concern beyond national boundaries. That goes back at least to the early 70s. In the context of the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe, we joined with our allies to advocate freedom of religion in the Eastern Bloc. In 1975, the signatory states of the final act of the Helsinki Conference adopted the so-called Decalogue. Principle 7 expressly lists religious freedom among the human rights which the states commit themselves to respect in order to ensure peace and security for their own citizens. And by the way, this includes not only the right to hold or not to hold and to change one's beliefs, but also to profess them openly, a point with particular relevance in a secular society. We will see, as the Office of Religious Freedom begins to function, if it addresses even partly religion as a dimension of foreign policy. For me, this means religion included as a variable to be weighed along with others in the analysis of interests and motivations that explain the conduct of a given state or a non-state group in an international context or within a state, and also as a factor in an ensuing policy response. Now, some scholars have written about religion as the, quote, missing dimension of statecraft, and have blamed wrong policy decisions on the absence of attention paid to the religious elements of a conflict. I'm not sure, however, that in the Canadian case, the acknowledgement of the religious factor has been entirely lacking in our diplomacy. I also feel that the efficacy of reaching our foreign policy objectives always requires putting the spotlight on the religious factor. Where's Professor Sharma? I very much appreciated the point he made about this. I would submit two considerations. The first is that before our society became secularized, the religious factor was part of the home environment and the formative background of diplomats and public officials involved in foreign policy formulation. A bit like Monsieur Jourdan in Molière, who spoke in prose without knowing it, the religious element would have come to mind along with the social, economic, and political as qualifiers or identifiers in the analysis of a given situation. Today, someone who would have grown up in an environment where religion should be private and public discourse devoid of faith-based references is less likely, I think, to have a sure understanding of an environment where this is not the culture. Another consideration is subjective and difficult to assess, as it concerns the personal convictions of elected officials who make and carry out foreign policy. These convictions do not necessarily relate to their personal views about faith or non-belief. The recognition of how important such personally held views may be to others and the respect they must be accorded is sufficient. Foreign Minister Lloyd Axworthy has written in his book of the role his personal beliefs played at the time of decision-making around the issue of Kosovo in the 1990s. Just, 2 days ago, students sponsored by the Tony Blair Faith Foundation course on religion and foreign policy, underway at McGill, heard Senator Noel Kinsella, the Speaker of the Canadian Senate, speak of the importance of his faith as he engages in parliamentary diplomacy. The visibility of religion as an international political issue, as opposed to a factor in regional politics, grew significantly in the aftermath of 9/11. Before that, however, the disintegration of the Soviet Union and the consequent unrest in the Caucasus, along with events in the Horn of Africa, had already prompted the Department of Foreign Affairs in 1993 to look at the prominence of Islam as a factor in a number of events across Central and South Asia and Africa. That happened, in fact, when I was Director General of Policy Planning Bureau, and we were already, as many were, noticing a phenomenon that was not necessarily local or regional, but was beginning to be much wider, and obviously that could not be ignored in the Canadian context because of the communities at home. However, as the name indicates, the Working Group on Muslim Communities, it was very much an effort to understand what was going on in various Muslim communities, and it was not an attempt to actually focus on what was the big concern at the time, which was mostly a security or a radicalization or a terrorism issue. It was much broader than that. So religion itself became the subject of debate in the United Nations and other international instances when the terms Islamophobia and later Christianophobia entered the discussion on intolerance and religious persecution at the UN and other international gatherings. Muslim countries introduced defamation of religion then as a concept, which was new and not reflected in international human rights law that has applied up to now to individuals and persons belonging to communities. There's a strong body of law covering rights such as freedom of expression, freedom of conscience, freedom of religion, and protections, including from hate, incitation to hate and discrimination on several grounds, including religion. The word Christianophobia appeared in writing in UN documents 10 years ago. The use of the expression was not really favored at first by Christian leaders, including the Catholic Church, as you know, who is represented at the UN. However, organizations, including the Pew Forum, and we look forward to the presentation, have documented that Christians are presently the most persecuted faith group in the world. In a talk in Rome in 2004, the Holy See's then foreign minister put it in those terms. It should be recognized that the war against terrorism had as a side effect the spread of Christianophobia in vast areas of the globe, where Western civilization or certain political strategies of Western countries are erroneously considered to be determined by Christianity, or at least not separated from it. So let me conclude with some personal observations after this very, very cursory survey of elements I think must come in when we discuss religion and foreign policy. There's a link between promoting freedom of religion in other countries as a fundamental human right and what place our institutions give to the contribution of faith-based groups at home. Our values have to be consistent as to what is respect for human dignity and freedom of conscience. Advocacy for the rights of people belonging to religious minorities, promotion of understanding in multi-confessional society, and prevention of intolerance, violence, discrimination, and persecution of people belonging to religious minorities are goals that Canada pursues through various channels and now through the Office of Religious Freedom. We do so in good company with like-minded countries because we have a long tradition of protecting the rights of individuals wherever they may be, in keeping with our Judeo-Christian heritage and in our interest, given that we are a country of immigration, with links to communities around the globe. While human rights, including religious rights, have long featured in our foreign policy, the underlying values have evolved at home. New patterns of immigration have changed our confessional makeup, and our charter protections on freedom of religious belief are being challenged. We're not in the United States, where the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops has seen fit to set up an ad hoc committee on religious liberty. However, we have reached a point where Quebec, some medical professionals are fighting to retain the right to conscientious objection on the grounds of their religious beliefs. We all know that a country's foreign policy is but an extension of its domestic policies. It allows us to project our values abroad. There is, however, a corollary. It also opens us to scrutiny. It allows us to find out how Canada is perceived from the outside by many who look to us as a model of a tolerant society that works in the respect of reasonably held and expressed beliefs for the good of all in society. And here I'd like to enter in a little debate about the word tolerance. And I also agree with Professor Sharma that it has evolved, certainly in the context here, it has a positive connotation. Freedom of conscience at home and advocacy of freedom of religion abroad go together. They are part of the same continuum as we are reminded in the initial lines of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. How we manage our challenges at home, you can call it the Canadian model, speaks louder than words and is a powerful element in our foreign policy. How we act institutionally and as importantly as communities will have an impact beyond our borders. So we have a responsibility to continue to get it right to ourselves and many in the world who need to see that it's possible to everyone's benefit. Thank you very much.
you, Ambassador Leahy. Dr. Robert Shustro will be offering a short response. He's Assistant Professor of International Relations at Redeemer University College in Canada. He worked for 6 years with a Canadian think tank, CARDIS, where he wrote, spoke, and researched on issues of religious freedom and foreign affairs. He's editor with John Chaplin of God and Global Order, The Power of Religion in American Foreign Policy. Published a range of commentaries and articles on public and foreign affairs in a variety of publications, including an important one for our concerns, IGE's journal, The Review of Faith and International Affairs. He's recently completed his PhD work at Bath University, and his dissertation focused on the development of Canada's Office of Religious Freedom, a study which I'm confident will be published shortly.
Thanks very much. Thanks very much, Dan, for that kind introduction. I'm aware that I'm in the unenviable position of having to confess to being both an activist and now a scholar, but not having near the experience of the people who've recently addressed us. And so I'm honored, really, to share a table with Ambassador Anne Leahy and to offer some reflections. Although I have such great respect for her work, I don't know how controversial I can be to disagree, but I'll do my best. So, I'll address in turn the points that you made, and in terms of continuity, coherence, and then person focused, and sort of take the conversation from there. Hopefully, leaving a good bit of time still for conversation. In the first place, continuity. I think it's quite important to say and to argue that religious freedom is an authentically Canadian principle. And I don't say that just by way, incidentally, of celebration. I think that is something worth sustaining and celebrating. But it's also true, as I believe Senator Kinsella said in his speech, that it's an authentically Canadian principle because it's been an authentically Canadian struggle throughout Canadian history as well. And so we come by this virtue and this principle honestly. We come by it over many years of conversation about what has, in retrospect, been called reasonable accommodation. The Manitoba schools crisis just after Confederation, the inflammatory broadcasts by Jehovah's Witness student groups here in Montreal in the 1920s that resulted in the banning of all single-faith radio stations for decades, and the list goes on and on and on right up to the present day. So we come to the conversation, I think, as Canadians, honestly and with integrity. The reason why I think that's important to emphasize in terms of the continuity that Anne was discussing is that this is not, for example, a foreign imposition to the Canadian conversation or the Canadian foreign affairs dialogue. There were some concerns leading up to the establishment of the Canadian Office of Religious Freedom in the media as well as in other academic circles that this was an essentially sort of American idea that was coming north of the border. Well, religious freedom is an American idea that deserves to be celebrated, but it's not only an American idea. It is also a Canadian idea. And I think to leverage that continuity, it behooves us, I think it's incumbent on us as Canadians, to develop and to articulate perhaps where those ideas have existed in our foreign policy. And Anne has actually done some of that, and we've been in conversation the last couple of days trying to kind of mine the history of Canadian foreign relations and Canadian domestic policy even, for where some of those things have been implicitly and in some cases explicitly present. So that is also to say, there is not a long list currently of, I would say, pundits and academics in this country that are looking at the issue of religious freedom in Canadian foreign affairs. And it was said over dinner last night, although I won't attribute it, understanding that dinner is probably Chatham House rules, that academics tend to think things only exist once they start writing about them. fair point. In this case, academics need to start writing about it so we can start saying that we think it exists, because it really does exist, and it's actually been there in the history, and that deserves to be brought out. So this isn't simply something. So there isn't a kind of reaction within certain quarters, which there has been, I think. And perhaps unfairly so, that this is an American idea, this isn't a Canadian idea. Well, it is a Canadian idea. Now, all of that said, I think it would be sad and probably foolish if we did not nonetheless engage in a robust dialogue with our American neighbors who have indeed been on this topic in an explicit way, conversationally, since at least 1998 and before that. So those conversations should be happening, certainly, but I think there needs to be a much broader, a much deeper development of the constituency, both in terms of media as well as academia here in Canada, that begins to sort of own this principle in our own way, as diplomats already have been, I think, in many situations. The second place, coherence. This is also terribly important. The idea that religious freedom is a human right that needs to be understood along with a variety of other human rights. It does not somehow sit apart. It actually needs to come alongside. But also that religious freedom can serve in its distinctive role as a human right as a kind of resource for religion and foreign policy generally. Which I think is terribly important and also very difficult to cultivate. I will do a comparison here to the American experience recently, and I'll refer actually to some of the comments that Dennis Hoover, as well as I think Chris Seipel, made when they made recommendations to the Obama administration a number of years ago. I think it was 2011, and then that's by way of footnotes. So since 1998, many exceptionally talented people have labored long to bring religious freedom as a human right and religious literacy generally as a foundational field of knowledge in the Foreign Service, into the fore in America. The United States has made some modest gains, and I think some of these are worth looking at the very least, in incorporating religion into the foreign policy process. Since June of 2011, the Foreign Service Institute has held three sessions of a four-day religion and foreign policy course, an expansion from a prior three-day course. The course has graduated almost 100 Foreign Service, Civil Service, and locally employed staff. Religious freedom, religious engagement, have been integrated into promoting human rights, democracy, and labor courses. The Department of State has hosted senior interagency policy seminars on religious engagement. They did that in March of 2011. I think they continue to do that. And they launched a seminar, actually, on religion and foreign policy in October of this past year, regularly incorporating religious freedom and human rights promotion into training areas for Foreign Service officers and ambassadors. All of that said, we heard this week, and if any of you tuned in last week to hear Thomas Farr and Chris Seipel reflect in committee, in congressional committee, that it has been a tremendous uphill struggle in many ways to move not simply the human right of religious freedom, but also this sort of bedrock religious literacy, which is so fundamental going forward for the foreign policy of both America and Canada. In fact, they used some pretty stark language in terms of the difficulty and difficulties that they felt had been faced in that context. And so I think there are some lessons to be learned there because, the Americans have been explicitly at this longer than Canada has, and I don't think we can sort of afford some of the same missteps along the way. So there are some lessons there in terms of the coherence of bringing religious literacy into Canadian foreign policy that can be seen. I will quote, because he's here, and also because it's a very fine quote, Ambassador Bennett, who wrote in 2011, before he rose to the esteemed rank of ambassador, but when he was still a very well-respected academic. And I will quote him here as regards the importance of coherence, not simply of religious freedom, but religion in policy and foreign policy in particular. I quote him here. In order to properly engage Saudi Arabia, he is talking more broadly in the context, but this is the one country he uses as an example. In order to properly engage Saudi Arabia in dialogue on a whole range of issues, from human rights to economic, foreign, and defense policy, it behooves policymakers in Europe and the Americas to confront their own presumptions that religion and politics cannot and should not mix. And further on, he says, expressions of moderate religious faith should rightly be accorded their public place within 21st century politics, so that both international and domestic political discourse can be enriched by their perspectives. Perspectives, it must be said, that lie at the core of human development. End quote. And for those of you who are looking for the footnote, that's her Faith in 21st Century Politics, Global Brief in 2011. One of the things that Ambassador Bennett has encouraged was just reported in an interview actually with a magazine in the United States last week, I think it was, is that he's continued a suggestion that's already been in place, but he's specifically focused on encouraging diplomats serving overseas to make a practice of attending the court trials of those accused of religious infraction or a freedom of belief or conscience issues. This serves a couple of really practical, helpful things. First, he talks about what a difference it makes just to know that there's a Canadian diplomat sitting in attendance, or in some cases sitting outside the door, not allowed to attend, but nonetheless there. And second, of course, this is a real opportunity for very practical learning. This isn't just a case where they're learning about religious freedom and a human right, but there's also a case in which there's tremendous learning taking place about the relationship between religion and politics generally, and how this can be thought of often in very different ways than ways than we're perhaps comfortable or used to thinking about it in Canada or even in America. And so I think this is a very laudable, very practical initiative that the ambassador has pushed forward, and I think more of the same, more creative thinking of this like would do us well. Finally, person focused, and I'll simply say this because I'm pretty sure that you agree with me. In fact, I'm not sure you've disagreed with anything I've said. So I perhaps not fulfilled my role well there, but person-focused. I'll simply say this. I think also it's important to think about not simply persons, but also institutional and systemic reformation as it's related. And in this way, I'll sort of invoke and probably badly paraphrase the tagline of the Institute for Global Engagement and one of the phrases they use, that they're not just interested in getting people out of prison, they want to create environments, sustainable environments, where people don't go to prison in the first place. So I think that is person-focused, but it's also system-focused. And I think that's the work that an Office of Religious Freedom is particularly well-suited to do in the months and the years ahead. Thank you.
We have a few minutes for questions before our next talk. Use the front mic if you have a question. Mark.
Hello there. My name is Mark. I'm a student at McGill with the with the globalization class right now. Just to take the opportunity as well to thank Dr. Justra and Madame Leahy for the wonderful words and questions and contributions so far. But what I wanted to ask, in my experience, particularly on Quebec, are the greatest threat to efforts of outreach that we've described thus far, it's sort of an inability for individuals here to understand religious traditions they may not share, nor even acknowledge. I'm just thinking to some statements made by the provincial government in the past few weeks, and also apparent in the local reaction I encountered to the starting of the Religious Freedoms Office here on campus. A basic literacy of diversity inherent in religion, or the multiplicities that may be, or belief is necessary to engage in the first place. So as perhaps both a hearty suggestion and a question, might there be a manner to spread the knowledge of the reality that Canada and Quebec are multiplicities of faith, perhaps even in line with recent provincial ad campaigns where we had sort of this for same-sex relationships, even if it might not be something one agrees with. It's more to just raise awareness as well. So yeah, would there be a way to spread that knowledge? Because often it's just we don't even acknowledge that religion should play a place in social ongoings and whatnot.
Can I? I think you've made a very good point. All of you may not know, what am I doing wrong here? That I guess it's only 2 weeks ago, there was a was a local decision taken by the Quebec Soccer Federation to prevent a young boy, I mean, we're talking 12, 13, 14 year olds, playing soccer because he was a Sikh student wearing his head covering. And you have to know that, so this created an outroar. The Canadian Soccer Federation allows it in every other province. And unfortunately, in the interview of the person representing the Quebec Soccer Federation, the argument used was, what you know, for short, laïcité, no outward religious sign, and then mumbled something about security on the playing field, which was quickly shot down since the rest of Canada plays without any problems with head coverings. So that's a bit what you were referring to. We can talk about religious freedom because we have some pretty dark episodes in our history. Mm-hmm. Okay, there's a book called None is Too Many, you know, referring to a Canadian official treatment of a boat with Jewish people on it during the Second World War. So we're, you know, but at least we try and do better. What is encouraging about the incident that you have in mind is that it's the reaction of the people, the reaction of the kids, the reaction of the parents, and the intelligent reaction of someone in the Quebec Soccer Federation to say, well, if they're referring to a FIFA rule here, let's go and ask the official rule, opinion of FIFA. Thank God FIFA came back and said, it's hogwash, anyone can play as long as you're not endangering. I mean, I thought personally, frankly, the American football players play with equipment like this. I mean, they look like Iron Men, and there's no security arguments, so why not the soccer field? So over a period of 3 days, the Quebec Federation, you know, used the FIFA umbrella and said, oh, of course, they said it's all right, so I guess we'll just retract and say it's all right. But it did bring out some tensions because a few people saw fit to, not keep the custody of their tongue and say that, you know, they were all in favor of this and we shouldn't have any religious display on the playing field. And a very prominent politician actually approved of that and who had to probably swallow their words right now. But to get to your point, we will have a debate in the fall, as I'm sure you're aware, of the Charte de la Laïcité, now Call of the Quebec Values. So I think those who are not yet aware of the multi-confessional character will soon be. But you point a very fundamental point, and that's a good point, is that, and it was made by Mr. Seipel earlier, in order to respect people, you need to know about them. You need to know about them in an unbiased fashion, and you get to know about them by living with them. And it's hard for the younger ones who are always on Wikipedia and all that, but you have to discern what is the propaganda, the incitation from what is the real down-to-earth everyday experience. But that's a good point.
Ambassador Bennett?
No. A very quick point. First of all, I want to thank you for your very fair treatment of this whole question, because it is such an important one. But I wanted to raise the question of religious literacy. And really, I can't emphasize how important it is. In Canada, as in many other Western countries, we've done a very good job over many centuries of pushing religious discourse so firmly into the private sphere that we have often forgotten how to have the public discourse. And this is a point that's been brought home to me by many of my colleagues in the Foreign Service who feel that they don't often know how to engage, as you rightly pointed out, Anne. They don't know how to engage when they go to countries where religion dominates economic, political life. One very early initiative that we're undertaking is to develop a fairly comprehensive toolkit that we will be circulating to missions abroad to help Foreign Service officers, when they encounter these issues, to have a very good understanding of religious experience, religious communities in those countries. And one of my goals is, hopefully after the end of my appointment, 3 years or whenever it might come, is to have a Foreign Service that has the most nuanced understanding of religious issues of any Foreign Service in the world. And I think we can accomplish that. But I want to just add one caveat, and I'd like to get your thoughts on this. It's fine to increase literacy of religion, religious literacy, and I very much appreciate that I'm here in this department that has a focus on comparative religion and a sort of social scientific approach as well as a theological approach. But I think it's also very important to have faith literacy. After all, we're here under the auspices of the Tony Blair Faith Foundation. Religion without faith cannot be understood fully. And so I think it's very important that in the work that we're doing, yes, we talk about, you know, freedom of religion, we seek to have a better understanding of religion's role in society, but we can't just look at it purely as religion alone, per se. We have to understand it in the context of how people profess it, how people live it, and how faith shapes that experience. Because that gets back, I think, to what Ambassador Seipel was saying, it really becomes a very deeply held part of our identity, and that's the faith element that comes in. So I'd just like your comments on faith literacy in addition to religious literacy.
I can't not but completely agree with that sentiment, obviously. And I think we may define faith and religion a little bit differently, but nonetheless, I think the heart of what you're saying, I absolutely agree with, the idea that religion as a practice, as an embodied sort of thing, needs to be understood. It's more than just sort of what's happening between the ears. It's not just cerebral. It's deeply embedded often in social and familial relations, and to come to understand that is more than just an academic exercise. Now, before I get too dour on academia, I'd also like to point out that I think academia could do, and in some cases is poised to do, research and teaching and formation, if I can put it in that way, that helps us understand and respect religious traditions and diversity in a way that's more than just, you know, facts in a textbook about religion. I think there's a lot of room there for growth, particularly in Canada. And I'm encouraged by signs that I see, but I'd obviously like to see more. So.
I should say that one of the ways in which the intensive course in this program has been designed is in the opening week was deliberately designed to bring in men and women with academic expertise as well as involvement within their own faith communities. So these two things do not have to be at odds with each other. You can have informed expertise and yet with the sensitivity to the importance of the significance of religious commitment, empathy for the religious commitment, the critical importance of religious commitment, which I think Ambassador Bennett pointed out is so crucial.
Let me just say something just to be a little controversial is that as a diplomat, as a government official, or as someone who is not a theologian, a religious representative, I think we have to be very mindful of our own sphere of responsibility. And I would not say, I can say it now publicly, I'm no longer briefly in government, but I would not say that the Canadian government should encourage the promotion of religion. Okay, religious rights as part of human rights. And there are instruments, and by the way, I think international humanitarian law is well equipped, but we need, of course, it's always in the application that we need to look at. And Andrew, by the way, 1980 is part of the little things I did. I used to go to the courthouse and sit outside the courthouse because I couldn't go in when there was a trial of someone for a religious, because of their trying to profess their religion. And I know some other countries where colleagues did that. So indeed, the demonstration effect that someone cares about you, you're not alone, is very important. But I just wanted to say a word of caution, not to overdo the religion thing, because it is a controversial, it is sensitive, and you don't want to create a backlash particularly because it seems to be Western countries who seem to be pushing this. And I think the Holy See foreign minister was pretty perceptive when he merged policies with civilization and Christianity and worsening the situation for people on the ground. But again, as non-religious people, I think we have to not step into the territory of religious leaders as well.
Good warning. Thank you, Anne Leahy and Rob, for your contributions. And